Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll hear about an international effort to develop an environmental code of conduct for multinational corporations and small businesses. You'll learn how to hear the Environment Show anytime on your home computer via the World Wide Web. Our Ear to the Ground explores a group working deep in the rainforest to educate students around the world. And our Earth Calendar catalogs critters who perform mid-air 90-degree turns in the middle of a thick forest. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Have you ever wondered why the prongs of all electrical plugs are the same size, or the threads on bolts are uniform so they can be interchanged? Chances are that the manufacturer has agreed to make the product in accordance with standards set by the International Standards Organization, or ISO. This is a voluntary process. Now, an ISO standard is being formulated by representatives of industry, government, and citizens groups to bring about an environmental code of conduct. It's called ISO 14000. Dorothy Bowers is the Vice President of Environment and Safety at Merck & Company and chairperson of an ISO subcommittee. She explains what ISO 14000 is all about.
What we're talking about is first develop that an organization that wants to manage its environmental impact most cost-effectively and most effectively would implement something called an environmental management system. And so that's what ISO 14000 is really all about, setting up a protocol and a program and recommendations for organizations to follow in putting a system in place to manage their environmental aspects.
Mary McKeel directs the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Standards Network. She describes what a company would have to do to get certified.
The top person in an organization has to commit to managing their environmental impacts. Then secondly, you have to identify those impacts by taking a look at what are all the ways in which your business has an impact on the environment. What are the most significant? Once you've identified those, you set goals and objectives. And then you put training systems in place for your employees so they know what they're doing. And then you have a review and an internal audit system so that you know how the whole thing is working and that you can see the results. And then for continuous improvement, you have to continually go back and reestablish the goals, see where your system is not working, fix that part of it, and continually review what you do. So that's, you know, it's plan, do, act, review, and that's over and over again.
Procedures are being designed to ensure that companies who are certified under ISO 14000 environmental standards follow the rules.
According to the ISO 14000 standard, an organization can choose to do that, verify its performance in one of several ways. The most common way and the most likely way to be done is third-party verification, where an organization will go to an outside certifier, a third party, who will come in and verify once every 3 years that, in fact, the company has the program in place, can document that it's doing what it says it's doing, and will be reviewed in depth that, in fact, that's taking place.
Joel Charm is the Director of Health, Safety, and Environment for Allied Signal Corporation and Chairman of the ISO Technical Advisory Group. He says the program will have an impact.
I think it's going to be very significant. At a minimum, I think it is going to be viewed as the basis for an acceptable environmental management system globally. It will be the level playing field standard, meaning that if an organization wants to do business in a, for example, a third world country where environmental protection may not be of the highest priority, this will provide an internationally recognized norm for environmental protection. That's number one. I think it will facilitate the free flow of goods and services worldwide. One of the concerns was whether this would be a trade barrier, a non-tariff trade barrier, but we think it's been created in a way that it actually will enhance the free flow of goods and services. Thirdly, I believe that agencies at the federal and the state level will be looking to use this standard as an alternative approach to the traditional command and control approach of our current regulatory structure in the United States.
The obvious question is whether voluntary standards will be effective. Jonathan Lash, president of the World Resources Institute and environmental research organizations, thinks they will.
The teeth come in the process of commerce. If a major corporation that has outside suppliers across the world insists that each of its suppliers be certified under a standard, that becomes a floor for the operation of all serious businesses. Some 50% of trade globally is not at arm's length, but is within the family. It's between one company and its subsidiary or its contractual supplier. So it can have an enormous impact if it's self-enforced.
Lash sees the development of ISO 14000 as an important step in the effort to achieve a better environment around the globe.
It seems to me significant for two reasons. The first one is really quite obvious to all of us. For years, the process of environmental progress was based on contentious battles between government insisting on performance and industries resisting. Yet here is an example in which the levels of performance may be set and enforced by industries themselves on a voluntary basis because they see it to be in their own interests to assure that all of their competitors meet the same standards. That's a very interesting step. It also signifies a change in that while individual countries have set standards for environmental performance, there has not yet been any process for global harmonization, for bringing those standards to the developing world. And this could be a powerful tool to improve performance in countries where there is either a lack of standards or a lack of enforcement.
During the next few months, the ISO 14000 standards will be adopted. Then a time will come when you will be able to insist that a multinational corporation or a mom-and-pop enterprise be ISO 14000 certified before you buy their products or do business with them. I'm Peter Burley.
I'm Thomas Lally, producer of The Environment Show. We want as many of you as possible to hear The Environment Show, so now you can hear it anytime on your personal computer over the Internet. Todd Wagner, CEO of AudioNet, spoke with Peter Burley about how it all works.
What it basically does is allows you for the first time ever to stream audio through your computer, whereas maybe 6 months ago, 8 months ago, you had to download a WAV file in order to be able to listen to any audio. What now we can do for the first time, and literally this is brand new technology, for the last 6 months now we've been able to make it possible for people to stream audio through their computer. So in other words, it's on demand, it's in real time, as opposed to a file that has to be downloaded and then you could only hear a part of it.
Now, when I get to the Environment Show webpage, mm-hmm. and I ask to listen to the show, and the show shows up and I select the one that I want, where has that show been hiding? Well, it's been waiting for me to call it up off our webpage.
Well, that show actually has already, if it's something that's been, so to speak, archived or placed on our server, in other words, it's already sitting on our computer back here. And what someone does is they're literally accessing it through the magic of the Internet and through the magic of the web browser, one that people are most familiar with is Netscape. But through the magic of those that type of technology, then, what that does is access it from our server, which then basically places that onto the Internet so that they can listen to it through their computer.
To get to the Environment Show on your personal computer, here's what to do. Go to our Environment Show webpage at www.wamc.org/env. The first time you do it, click on the little sign that says Real Audio on the bottom of the page. The Real Audio page will then appear and tell you how to download the free software. You'll get a choice of version 1 or version 2. I put 1 and the installer in my Mac laptop in about 10 minutes. I'm told that version 2 gives you better sound, but requires more computer capacity. Once you have installed the software, return to the Environment Show page. Then click on Listen to the Environment Show. You will see a new page with our most recent show listed. And then click on the one you want to hear.
I'm Peter Burley. We're always interested in what you have to say. So write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Or reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. You've already heard about our webpage, and we hope you'll listen to us on your personal computer. That's www.wamc.org/env. Still ahead, our Ear to the Ground visits a group of the Amazon River Basin reaching out to the students of the world. Professor at Berkshire Community College and editor of the Berkshire Reader, Dick Nunley, presents his very personal portrait of the Adirondacks. And our Earth Calendar looks at critters who perform mid-air acrobatics in the middle of a dense forest. These stories still ahead on the Environment Show.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, education and preservation in the Amazon. The lush rainforest of the Amazon supports the most prolific and diverse array of flora and fauna found anywhere in the world. In birds alone, the Amazon contains almost one-third of the planet's species. Since 1991, the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research, or ASIR, has been working to save the rainforest.
The purpose of the ASIR is to promote environmental education and disseminate the education and training, not only at basic level, but also professional level in the Amazon rainforest.
Yvonne Mejia is executive director of ASIR.
The purpose of this training, awareness education and conservation education and scientific research, is to preserve the rainforest biodiversity. You know that by educating not only at the school level, but educating the population, training scientists and professionals how to do better management resources, and spreading the world about the problems of the rainforest and the problems of ecosystems is the best way to preserve the rainforest. If you don't educate people, you will not get people concerned about preserving the rainforest.
ASIR's administrative headquarters are in Helena, Alabama, while its research facility is located in 250,000 acres of primary rainforest deep within the upper Amazon basin. 4 miles upriver from Iquitos, the Amazon's main town. Powered by solar energy, the facility currently houses about 40 people. A laboratory is under construction to facilitate researchers and workshops, and Asir also has a canopy walkway.
The canopy walkway, it's a special infrastructure we have there. It's the highest and longest canopy walkway that exists on Earth above the canopy level. It was built with the purpose to facilitate also scientific research and educational programs.
Mejia says that from the canopy walkway, there's an amazing 360-degree view, dotted with hundreds of birds and flowers of many colors. It is, she says, a rare way to experience the beauty of the rainforest.
When you are in the rainforest, you are walking in the ground. It's dark. It's kind of humid, although it's hot, but it's humid and dark. The canopies cover the whole area. While you are close to the canopies, you see the sky and the sun, and you can see the darkness of the rainforest inside. So it's a very dramatic experience.
Asir has many programs designed to increase awareness of the rainforest. Working closely with the local population and with the approval of the Peruvian Board of Education, Mejia says they help train rural Amazonian teachers with lesson plans about the rainforest. They also have helped thousands of Amazonian school children receive badly needed school supplies through their Adopt-a-School program. This program pairs American schools with rural Peruvian schools, exchanging letters, pictures, and educational materials. Mejia adds, in addition, Asir also provides workshops and professional training in such things as environmental mapping for Peruvian scientists, universities, research institutes, or government.
By this program, we work in cooperation with the Westchester University professionals who go to Peru and train professionals over there how to better use the resources, implement their database about the rainforest, and so they are learning to use the satellite system so they can better study the resources over there and plan what should be done or what should not be done.
Mejia says that Asir does not work with big foundations. Their support, she says, comes from small companies, individual donations, and ecotourism. In conjunction with an organization called International Expeditions, Mejia says Asir provides controlled visits in the Amazon. Travelers, she says, gain an appreciation and understanding of the rainforest while helping to support Asir. With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
We all have places which are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's a place deep in the wilderness. Dick Nunley is professor at Berkshire Community College in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and editor of the Berkshire Reader. He often spends time in the Adirondack Mountains of New York and has this portrait of his special place there.
In the Adirondacks, one overcast day last August, we made a lazy flat water paddle from one forest pond to another and another, from Church to Osgood to Jones. We put in near Paul Smith's, within earshot of the busy main road to Canada. But within 5 strokes of the paddle, we were in another world, crossing high-banked Church Pond and rounding a hummock of hardhack, gliding into the eerily still Little Osgood. Its mirror-like black water doubled the white skeletons of blown-down spruce tangled around its edge. From Little Osgood, a 6-foot-wide channel led through a dim hemlock grove into Osgood Pond itself, taking us past a campsite where a group of Amish women in their caps and long old-fashioned dresses stood like ghosts among the trees. Beyond a piney point, all of Osgood opened up. A far-off line of low blue mountains lay across the bottom of the sky, and wide reaches of empty gray water glittered ahead. Not an engine or motorboat was to be heard. We were looking for the flow that, according to the map, leads back to Jones Pond. We found it behind a concealing point where a yellow sandbar had built up. A couple of women with orange kayaks pulled up on a bushy little beach there informed us that beaver dams blocked the way, but we decided to give it a try. Almost immediately, we were gliding through a Winslow Homer watercolor, a silent world of tamarack and swamp maple where the flow meandered in and out of patches of blue pickerel weed and white arrowhead, the peaty water the color of tea. The first beaver dam had been breached, and one vigorous dig with the paddles got us up and over. But the second, a couple of hundred yards upstream, was a stoutly woven basket-like weir 30 inches high, gently spurting silver leaks. We climbed out into the water and lifted over, getting soaked, of course, but who cared? Every bend of the stream above the dam unfolded a new picture we glided into with the quiet elation of discovery. Then the woods fell back, and the slowed flow widened into Jones Pond. In waving stands of pale green marsh grass, redwings whistled, and the canoes nudged water lilies aside like casual stars. Around 2 o'clock, we pulled up in a blueberry thicket under tall pines. Dry thunder muttered in the distance as we ate our long-awaited sandwiches, the gray afternoon warm and still. We were far away, though never more than half a mile from main-traveled roads.
Dick Nunley is a professor at Berkshire Community College and editor of the Berkshire Reader. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Flying squirrels are extremely abundant in the United States, but few people ever see them, because like most small mammals, they're nocturnal. People who study them say day sightings are almost unheard of. Yet flying squirrels are a major source of food for many creatures throughout the world. Tom Rice studies southern flying squirrels at the Savannah River Ecology Lab in Aiken, South Carolina. He says mating season ended around the turn of the year, and the gestation period is coming to a close.
At this time of year, they'll give birth typically to 2 to 4 young pups, we call young squirrels. And this is a smaller litters than what they have in the fall. In the fall, they'll have litters up to 3 to 5 is a more typical range. And one of the more interesting things I'm finding is that in the fall, they give birth to more female babies, and in the spring or late winter breeding period, they give birth to more male babies. And I'm not sure exactly why that is, but it's something I'd like to look into.
In many ways, flying squirrels are a lot like other squirrels. They eat nuts and live in large hardwood trees. But there are things flying squirrels can do that a few other mammals can. So don't let their name fool you.
They should really be called gliding squirrels. They don't fly at all. So what they'll do as they move through their environment is they'll go up to an appropriate height, and then they usually pause before a takeoff. And you'll see them move their head from side to side because they're actually triangulating on the landing spot to see how far it is. Then they'll jump off the tree with an explosive burst. They're really quite athletic, and they'll extend their flight membrane. And as they land, they'll move their front limbs upwards and their bottom limbs backwards, and they'll lower their tail, which acts almost as a rudder or a stabilizer, and they'll make a touchdown feet first. And then when they land, they'll immediately spin around or run around to the backside of the tree to foil any predator that might have watched the glide. And if they're moving great distances, they'll continue up the tree, obtain an appropriate height again, and repeat the whole process.
The flight of a squirrel is about 60 yards. They're also known for their acrobatic turns, sometimes at 90-degree angles or more, as they avoid branches and trees in their paths. Just think, if Tarzan took lessons from a flying squirrel, maybe Jane would have been really impressed. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 318. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, and Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.